other could not cover the story. The lists of the dead trailed off. The war went on, but the lights went out. The underlying logic of the Russian war against Ukraine, Europe, and America was strategic relativism. Given native kleptocracy and dependence on commodity exports, Russian state power could not increase, nor Russian technology close the gap with Europe or America. Relative power could, however, be gained by weakening others, by invading Ukraine to keep it away from Europe, for example. The concurrent information war was meant to weaken the EU and the United States. What Europeans and Americans had that Russians lacked were integrated trade zones and predictable politics with respected principles of succession. If these could be damaged, Russian losses would be acceptable, since enemy losses would be still greater. In strategic relativism, the point is to transform international politics into a negative-sum game, where a skillful player will lose less than everyone else. In some respects, Russia did lose its war in Ukraine. No memorable case for Russian culture was made by the peoples of the Caucasus and Siberia journeying for hundreds or thousands of kilometers to kill Ukrainians who spoke Russian better than they did. The Russian annexation of Crimea and sponsorship of the Lugansk People's Republic and Donetsk People's Republic did complicate Ukraine's foreign relations. Even so, the frozen conflict was a far cry from the disintegration of Ukraine discussed in Russian policy papers and the massive expansion suggested by Novorossiya. Ukraine fielded an army while holding free and fair elections. Russia fielded an army as a substitute for such. Ukrainian society was consolidated by the Russian invasion. As the chief rabbi of Ukraine put it, "We're faced by an outside threat called Russia. It's brought everyone together." That overstatement suggested an important truth. For the first time in Ukrainian history, public opinion became anti-Russian. In the 2001 Ukrainian census, 17.3% of the inhabitants of the country identified themselves as ethnically Russian. By 2017, that figure had fallen to 5.5%. Some of that drop was a result of the inaccessibility of Crimea and parts of the Donbass oblasts to the survey. But the bulk of it was the result of the Russian invasion. An invasion to defend speakers of Russian killed such people by the thousand and induced them to identify as Ukrainian by the million. By invading Ukraine, annexing Crimea, and shooting down MH17, Russia forced the European Union and the United States to respond. The EU and US sanctions were a rather mild response to Russia's announced intention to remake the world order, as Lavrov put it. But they did isolate Russia from its major partners and deepen Russia's economic crisis. Putin pretended that China was an alternative. Beijing exposed Russia's weakness by paying less for Russian hydrocarbons. Russia's power rests upon its ability to balance between the West and the East. The invasion of Ukraine made Russia dependent on China without forcing the Chinese to do anything in return. Russia's Eurasian ideologists claim that the United States planned to steal Russia's resources. Antyufeyev, for example, presented Russia's war in Ukraine as a defensive campaign to prevent the United States from stealing Russia's natural gas and fresh water. This reflected a healthy imagination rather than familiarity with American energy production. Indeed, this attention to resources seemed like a displacement. It was Russia's neighbor China, not the United States, that lacked natural gas and fresh water. By claiming that international law did not protect state borders, Moscow opened the way for Beijing, when and if it so desired, to make a similar argument about the Chinese-Russian border. Almost everyone lost in the Russo-Ukrainian War. Russia, Ukraine, the EU, the United States. The only winner was China. On August 29, 2014, the day when Lavrov compared Russia's war against Ukraine to a computer game, Russian and European fascists and extreme-right politicians gathered on territory seized from Ukraine to simultaneously deny and celebrate the ongoing Russian invasion. Sergei Glazyov opened an international conference in Yalta under the heading of anti-fascism. He was, according to the program, joined by fellow Russian fascists Alexander Dugin and Alexander Prokhanov. The guests were the leaders of Europe's extreme right, Roberto Fiore from Italy, Frank Heilmann from Belgium, Luc Michel from Belgium, Pavel Cerner from Bulgaria, Martin Gyungis from Hungary, and Nick Griffin from Great Britain. Russian and European fascists considered founding an anti-fascist council. They denied the Russian invasion of Ukraine, though they were meeting in a city Russia had annexed. They denied that Russia was still fighting in eastern Ukraine at the time, though featured guests included Russian military commanders who had left the battlefield to be present. Within the European Union, it was rare to find a major political party that would take such positions. Yet such an option was emerging in Germany and would benefit from Russian support. A new German right-wing party called the AfD, Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany. Standing somewhere between the radicals at Yalta and more traditional parties, it would become Moscow's darling. Its leader, Alexander Gauland, a former member of the center-right Christian Democratic Union, accepted Russia's line on Crimea and positioned his party as a pro-Russian alternative, even as Moscow attacked the German establishment. In autumn 2014, Russia undertook cyber attacks against the German parliament and German security institutions. In May 2015, the Bundestag was attacked again. In April 2016, the Christian Democratic Union, Germany's largest political party, led by Angela Merkel, was also attacked. But the most important campaign undertaken to support the German extreme right against the German center would be in public. It would exploit an anxiety that Russians and Germans shared, Islam, against the common enemy of Moscow and the AfD, Chancellor Angela Merkel. Facing rising numbers of refugees from war in Syria, as well as migrants fleeing Africa, Merkel took an unexpected position. Germany would accept large numbers of refugees, more than its neighbors, more than her voters would have wished. On September 8, 2015, the German government announced that it planned to take 500,000 refugees per year. By no coincidence, Russia began bombing Syria 3 weeks later. Speaking at the United Nations on September 28, 2015, Putin proposed a harmonization of Eurasia with the European Union. Russia would bomb Syria to generate refugees, then encourage Europeans to panic. This would help the AfD and thus make Europe more like Russia. Russian bombs began to fall in Syria the day after Putin spoke. Russian aircraft dropped non-precision, dumb bombs from high altitudes. Even if the targets had been military, non-precision bombing would have guaranteed more destruction and more refugees making their way to Europe. But Russia was not generally targeting ISIS bases. Human rights organizations reported the Russian bombing of mosques, clinics, hospitals, refugee camps, water treatment plants, and cities in general. In her decision to accept Syrian refugees, Merkel was motivated by the history of the 1930s, when Nazi Germany made its own Jewish citizens into refugees. The Russian response was in effect to say, if Merkel wants refugees, we will provide them, and use the issue to destroy her government and German democracy. Russia supplied not just the refugees themselves, but also the image of them as terrorists and rapists. On Monday, January 11, 2016, a 13-year-old German girl of Russian origin, Lisa F., hesitated to return to her home in Berlin. She had once again had problems in school, and the way her family treated her had aroused the attention of authorities. She went to the house of a 19-year-old boy, visited with him and his mother, and stayed the night. Lisa F.'s parents reported her missing to the police. She returned home the next day, without her backpack and cell phone. She told her mother a dramatic story of abduction and rape. The police, following up the report of the missing girl, went to the residence of the friend and found her things. By speaking to her friend and his mother, finding the backpack, and reading text messages, they established where Lisa F. had been. When questioned, Lisa F. told the police what had happened. She had not wanted to go home and had gone elsewhere. A medical examination confirmed that the story she had told her mother was untrue. a Berlin family drama then played as global news on Russian television. On January 16, 2016, a Saturday, Первый канал presented a version of what Lisa F. had told her parents. She had been abducted by Muslim refugees and gang-raped for an entire night. This was the first of no fewer than 40 segments on Первый канал about an event that, according to a police investigation, had never taken place. In the televised coverage, photographs were pasted from other places and times to add an element of verisimilitude to the story. The Russian propaganda network Sputnik chimed in with the general speculation that refugee rapists were loose in Germany. On January 17th, the extreme-right National Democratic Party organized a demonstration demanding justice for Lisa F. Although only about a dozen people appeared, one of them was an RT cameraman. His footage appeared on YouTube the next day. The Russian information war had been ongoing for some time. Most Germans had not been paying attention. The Lisa F. affair was thus a direct hit on a soft target. The Berlin police issued a tactful press release explaining its findings, omitting names to protect the family, and requesting responsible use of social media. This was not the sort of thing that would slow a Russian propaganda campaign. The Russian media now proclaimed that the rape of a Berlin Russian girl was hushed up and that the police tried to hide it. The story spread from Первый канал across Russian television and print media, told the same way everywhere. The German state welcomed Muslim rapists, failed to protect innocent girls, and lied. On January 24th, a protest organized by an anti-immigration group was covered by Russian media under the headline, "Lisa, we are with you. Germans rally under Merkel's window against migrant rapists." The information war against Merkel was taken up openly by the Russian state. The Russian embassy in London tweeted that Germany rolled out the red carpet for refugees and then swept their crimes under the carpet. On January 26th, Foreign Minister Lavrov, referring unforgettably to a German citizen as "our Lisa," intervened on behalf of the Russian Federation. Lavrov claimed that he was forced to act because Russians in Germany were agitated. They were indeed because of what they had seen on Russian state television. As in Ukraine, the Russian state was claiming to act on behalf of people who were citizens and residents of another country. As in Ukraine, a fictional wrong was used to generate a sense of Russian victimhood and an occasion for the display of Russian power. Like the image of a crucified boy, that of a raped girl was meant to overwhelm. Not long before the "Our Lisa" affair, Amnesty International had published the first of several reports on Russian bombing of civilian targets in Syria. Physicians for Human Rights was also documenting Russian attacks on clinics and hospitals. On December 8, 2015, for example, Russian airstrikes destroyed the Al-Burnas Hospital, the largest children's clinic in rural western Idlib, injuring doctors and nurses and killing others. The actual people who were killed and maimed in Russian attacks, the girls and boys and women and men who died under bombing, were shrouded by the specter of Muslims as a rapist collective. Refugees from Syria, like refugees from Ukraine, were subsumed in a fiction of Russian innocence. The imagined violation of a single girl was meant to reverse the valence of the entire story. Merkel remained the leader of the largest party in Germany, and the only one capable of forming a government. Her position was weakened by the immigrant issue, in some part because of Russian intervention in German discussions. During the 2017 electoral campaign, Russian-backed social media in Germany portrayed immigration as dangerous, the political establishment as cowardly and mendacious, and the AfD as the savior of Germany. In the elections of September 2017, the AfD won 13% of the total vote, finishing third overall. This was the first time since the Nazis in 1933 that a far-right party had won representation in a German parliament. Its leader, Alexander Gauland, promised to hunt Merkel and to take our country back. Other European politicians were still less fortunate than Merkel. The Polish government of the Civic Platform Party, under Prime Minister Donald Tusk, had supported a European future for Ukraine. Polish flags had flown on the Maidan as young Poles traveled to Kiev to support friends. Members of an older generation, participants in the Polish anti-communist opposition, found on the Maidan something that they had never thought they would see again: solidarity across social classes and political parties. Polish Foreign Minister Radosław Sikorski had journeyed to Kiev to seek a negotiated settlement between protesters and government. That Polish government was then brought down. Tapes emerged of private conversations between civic platform politicians at restaurants. The problem was not that the tapes revealed scandals, although they did, but that they allowed Poles to hear how politicians speak in private. It is a rare politician who can survive his constituents knowing how he orders food or tells jokes. Sikorski was recorded issuing some rather sound political judgments, but in a language different from that which he used in public. The man who hired waiters to record the conversations owed $26 million to a company with close ties to Vladimir Putin. Two restaurants where conversations were taped were owned by consortia with connections to Semyon Mogilevich, regarded as the Don of Dons of the Russian mob. Crossing the line that divides public responsibility and private life was far more consequential than it appeared. The undesired exposure of private conversations was incipient totalitarianism in a country that had been a focal point of Nazi and Soviet aspirations during the 20th century. This point was rarely made. Polish memories of German and Soviet aggression tended to congeal around heroism and villainy. What got lost was the memory of how totalitarianism endured into the 1970s and 1980s, not by atrocities where the distinction between the perpetrator and victim is clear, but by an erosion of the line between private and public life that demolishes the rule of law and invites the population to participate in the demolition. Poles returned to a world of bugged conversations, unexpected denunciations, and constant suspicion. Public life cannot be sustained without private life. It is impossible to govern, even for the best of Democrats, without the possibility for discreet conversations. The only politicians who are invulnerable to exposure are those who control the secrets of others, or those whose avowed behavior is so shameless that they are invulnerable to blackmail. In the end, electronic scandals that reveal the hypocrisy of politicians who break rules help the politicians who disregard rules. Digital revelations end the careers of those who have secrets and begin the careers of those who promote spectacle. By accepting that the private lives of public figures are the same thing as politics, citizens cooperate in the destruction of a public sphere. This quiet emergence of totalitarianism, visible in Poland during the tape scandal of 2014, was also on display in the United States in 2016. It was perhaps no great surprise that Civic Platform lost the parliamentary elections in October 2015 to its right-wing rival, the Law and Justice Party. Civic Platform had been in power for almost a decade, and Poles had other reasons, aside from the tape scandal, for weary skepticism. Yet there was something unexpected about the government that was formed that November: the prominent place of the intemperate nationalist Antoni Macierewicz. During the campaign, Law and Justice had promised that Macierewicz, who over the decades had earned a reputation for jeopardizing Poland's national security, would not be named Minister of Defense. Then he was. A politician forever preoccupied with secrets and their revelation, Macierewicz was a natural beneficiary of the tape scandal. In 1993, he had brought down his own government with his unusual treatment of archival records concerning Polish communism. Entrusted with the delicate task of reviewing communist secret police files to find informers, he instead published a random list of names. The Macierewicz list of 1993 left out most of the actual agents, including Macierewicz's own political partner, Michał Lusznia. It did include figures who had nothing to do with the secret police, but who had long suffered trying to clear their names. In 2006, when the Law and Justice Party was in power, Macierewicz was entrusted with a second sensitive task: the reform of Polish military intelligence. He published a report that revealed its methods and named its agents, disabling it for the foreseeable future. he ensured that this report was quickly translated into Russian, employing a Russian translator who, in a previous job, had cooperated with Soviet secret services. In 2007, as head of the new military counterintelligence organization that he had founded, Machadevich transferred secret military documents to Jacek Kotas, a man known in Warsaw as the Russian Connection, because of his work for Russian firms linked to the Russian mobster Semyon Mogilevich. As defense minister in 2015, Machadevich arranged another spectacular breach of national security, organizing an illegal nighttime raid on a NATO center in Warsaw, whose assignment was to track Russian propaganda. Machadevich, a master of the politics of eternity, managed to submerge Poland's actual history of suffering in a political fiction. In office as Minister of Defense from 2015, Machadevich translated a recent human and political tragedy into a tale of innocence that allowed for a new definition of enemies. This was the Smolensk catastrophe of April 2010, the deadly crash of an airplane containing Polish political and civic leaders on their way to Russia to commemorate the Katyn massacre. At the time, the Polish government was led by Prime Minister Donald Tusk of the Civic Platform, whereas the president was Lech Kaczynski of Law and Justice. Tusk brought a governmental delegation to Smolensk for an official commemoration. The leaders of Law and Justice hastily arranged to send a rival delegation to a different set of commemorations. Only the living can commemorate the dead. The first mistake of the rival delegation was placing so much of the Polish elite on board two airplanes flying to the same place at the same time with essentially zero advance planning. The second mistake was to attempt to land those planes in prohibitive conditions at a military airfield for which the pilots were untrained. Although one found the airstrip through the fog, the second crashed in a forest, killing all passengers on board. In that second aircraft, elementary safety procedures had not been followed. The cockpit door had not been closed, denying the pilots their normal authority. Transcripts from the black box revealed that they had not wished to land, but had been pressured to do so by visitors from the back of the plane, including the commander of the Air Force. The black box transcripts suggested that President Lech Kaczynski had reserved the decision about landing for himself. His delegate spoke directly to the pilots of a decision from the president. This was not only inappropriate but disastrous, since it brought about not just his own death, but the death of all of his fellow passengers and the crew. The catastrophe was caused by avoidable human error. That fact was difficult to face. In the atmosphere evoked by Katyn, emotions ran high. They ran higher still in the Kaczynski family, where twin brothers, united by politics, were suddenly divided in an unexpected and horrible way. Within the Law and Justice Party, the accident brought a strange aftermath. One twin brother, Yaroslav, who now became leader of the Law and Justice Party, remained alive after the other twin brother, Lech, the president, had died in a confusing tragedy. It made matters worse that the two brothers had spoken a few minutes before the crash. Whatever else might have been said, it seemed clear that Yaroslav had not discouraged Lech from landing. Machadevich understood that the search for meaning after death can be channeled into useful political fiction. He created a mystery cult around the crash, floating implausible and contradictory explanations with the general implication that Putin and Tusk had cooperated in a political mass murder. His technique was strikingly similar to the way that Russian authorities had treated MH17. In the case of MH17, Russians had shot down a civilian airliner and sought to deny it. In the case of Smolensk, Russia had not shot down an airliner, but Machadevich seemed eager to prove that it had. But this difference is less important than the similarity. In both cases, the trail of evidence was abundant and convincing, and led to investigations with clear conclusions. In both cases, politicians of eternity spun tales designed to suppress factuality and confirm victimhood. Machadevich required that the list of victims of the Smolensk accident be read in public places and took part in spirited monthly commemorations. A word in Polish reserved for the heroic dead of wars and uprisings, polegli, was applied by Machadevich and others to the crash victims. After 2015, Smolensk became more important than the Katyn massacre that Polish leaders had wished to commemorate, more important than the entire Second World War, more important in the 20th century. The commemoration of Smolensk divided Polish society as only a fiction can. It alienated Poles from their allies, since no Western leader could believe in Macierewicz's version of events, or even pretend to believe in it. A quarter century of efforts by historians to convey the horrors of Polish history was wasted in a matter of months. Thanks to Macierewicz, the true history of Polish suffering was shrouded under nationalist lies. Tusk was elected president of the European Council, one of the top leadership positions in the European Union. It was difficult for European politicians to process Macierewicz's suggestion that Tusk had conspired with Putin to plan a mass murder. Macierewicz's accusations of Russia were so outlandish that he seemed like the last person who could be a Russian agent. Perhaps that was the point. Macierewicz promoted his cult of Smolensk while promoting men with connections to Moscow. As his Secretary of State, he appointed Bartosz Kownacki, a man who had traveled to Moscow to legitimate Putin's fraudulent election in 2012. As head of national cryptography, Macierewicz appointed Tomasz Mikołajewski, a man about whom little was known, beyond his inability to pass security background checks. For other appointments, he relied upon Jacek Kotas, the Russian connection. Kotas had a think tank that prepared cadres for Macierewicz. One of its position papers recommended that the Polish army be deprofessionalized and supplemented by a territorial defense that would deter protests against the government. That paper was co-written by Krzysztof Gaj, who had spread Russian propaganda about Ukrainian fascism. Macierewicz made the territorial defense subordinate to him personally, thus avoiding the command structure of the Polish armed forces. Soon it was funded at the same level as the entire Polish navy. He fired the vast majority of Poland's high-ranking staff and field generals, replacing them with inexperienced people, some of whom were known for their pro-Russian and anti-NATO views. Warsaw, meanwhile, abandoned the one policy that had distinguished it among its NATO and EU peers, the support of Ukrainian independence. Under the Law and Justice government, Warsaw chose to emphasize episodes of Polish-Ukrainian conflict in ways that suggested the total innocence of Poles. This was the Polish policy Malofejow had subsidized in 2014 without much success. Now it seemed that no subsidies were needed. Western allies were confounded. The French were told by Kownacki that Poles had taught them how to use forks. British intelligence concluded that Poland was not a reliable partner. Macierewicz had maintained some American connections, but these too led back to Russia. In 2010, when Macierewicz sought counsel on how to react to the Smolensk tragedy, he traveled to the United States. His contact in the American House of Representatives was Dana Rohrabacher, an American legislator who distinguished himself with his support of Vladimir Putin and Russian foreign policy. In 2012, the FBI warned Rohrabacher that he was regarded by Russian spies as a source. Kevin McCarthy, the Republican majority leader of the House of Representatives, later named Rohrabacher, along with Donald Trump, as the Republican politician most likely to be in the pay of Russia. In 2015, after Macierewicz became Minister of Defense, Rohrabacher traveled to Warsaw to meet him. In 2016, Rohrabacher went to Moscow to collect documents that Moscow believed would help the Trump campaign. Interestingly, Macierewicz took the trouble to defend Donald Trump from the charge that his campaign was connected to Russia. Macierewicz did not deny the facts that connected him to Moscow. Instead, he treated factuality as the enemy. When a journalist published a book detailing his Russian links in 2017, Macierewicz did not dispute its claims, nor sue the journalist in a civil court where he would have had to produce evidence. Instead, he claimed that investigative journalism constituted a physical attack on a government minister and initiated proceedings to try the journalist for terrorism before a military tribunal. He was replaced as Minister of Defense in January 2018. By that time, the European Union, specifically its executive body, the European Commission, was proposing to sanction Poland for violating basic principles of the rule of law. There is nothing inherently Russian about political fiction. Ilin and Surkov arrived at their conclusions because of their experiences in and aspirations for Russia. Other societies can yield to the same form of politics after a shock and a scandal, as in Poland, or as a result of inequality and Russian intervention, as in Great Britain and the United States. In his study of Russian media and society, published in 2014, Peter Pomerantsev concluded with a reflection that here is going to be there. The West is going to be like Russia. It was Russian policy to accelerate this process. If leaders were unable to reform Russia, reform had to seem impossible. If Russians believed that all leaders and all media lied, then they would learn to dismiss Western models for themselves. If the citizens of Europe and the United States joined in the general distrust of one another and their institutions, then Europe and America could be expected to disintegrate. Journalists cannot function amidst total skepticism. Civil societies wane when citizens cannot count on one another. The rule of law depends upon the beliefs that people will follow law without its being enforced, and that enforcement when it comes will be impartial. The very idea of impartiality assumes that there are truths that can be understood regardless of perspective. Russian propaganda was transmitted by protégés on the European far right, who shared Russia's interest in the demolition of European institutions. The idea, for example, that the Russian war on Sodom and the associated Russian invasion of Ukraine was a new Cold War, or a Cold War 2.0, was formulated by the Izborsk Club. It was a helpful notion in Russia, since it stylized gay bashing and then the invasion of a helpless neighbor while gay bashing as a grand confrontation with a global superpower over the shape of civilization. This trope of a new Cold War was spread by Marine Le Pen, the leader of the Front National, who used it on RT beginning in 2011 and during her July 2013 visit to Moscow. The leading American white supremacist, Richard Spencer, used the same term at the same time when interviewed by RT. The European and American far right also spread the official Russian claim that Ukrainian protests on the Maidan were the work of the West. The Polish fascist Mateusz Piskorski claimed that Ukrainian protests were the work of the U.S. Embassy. Heinz Christian Strache, the leader of Austria's Freiheitliche Party, blamed Western security services. Marton Gyongosi of the Hungarian Jobbik Party, whom the Russian press itself had classified as an anti-Semite and a neo-Nazi in the years before anti-Semites and neo-Nazis became RT commentators, said that the Maidan protests were arranged by American diplomats. Manuel Ochsenreiter, a German neo-Nazi, spoke of the Ukrainian revolution as imposed by the West. None of these people produced evidence. Russian conspiratorial ideas, spread by the European far right, found traction in some corners of the American right. The pronouncements of former Republican Congressman Ron Paul, who ran for president in 2008 and 2012, were particularly interesting. Paul, who described himself as a libertarian, had mounted powerful critiques of American wars abroad. Now he defended a Russian war abroad. Paul cited Sergei Glazyov with approval, although Glazyov's fascist politics and neo-communist economics contradicted Paul's libertarianism, and Glazyov's warmongering contradicted Paul's isolationism. Paul endorsed the Eurasia Project, which was again unexpected, given that its philosophical sources were fascist and its economics involved state planning. Paul, echoing a host of European fascists, claimed that the U.S. government pulled off a coup in Ukraine. Like them, he provided no evidence. Instead, he cited propaganda from RT. It was less surprising that Lyndon LaRouche, the leader of an American crypto-Nazi organization, followed Glazyov's line. LaRouche and Glazyov had been in collaboration for 2 decades around the idea of an international Jewish oligarchy, a genocide of Russians by Jewish liberals, and the desirability of Eurasia. In LaRouche's view, Ukraine was an artificial construction created by Jews to block Eurasia. Like Glazyov and other Russian fascists, LaRouche deployed familiar symbols of the Holocaust to define Jews as the perpetrators and others as the victims. On June 27, 2014, LaRouche published an article by Glazyov claiming that the Ukrainian government was a Nazi junta installed by the United States. Stephen Cohen borrowed Russian media terms of abuse at the same time, on June 30, 2014. Like LaRouche, Cohen endorsed the Russian propaganda claim that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was justified by Ukrainian genocide. The notion that Ukraine was perpetrating genocide was translated into English by RT and then spread by certain people on the American far right and the American far left. This propaganda effort exploited images associated with the Holocaust. These could be used by LaRouche to present Russians to American anti-Semites as the victims of Jews, or by Cohen to suggest to the American left and American Jews that Russian victimhood in 2014 was like Jewish victimhood in 1941. Either way, the result was not only to falsify events in Ukraine, but also to trivialize the Holocaust. Writing in The Nation, Cohen claimed that the Ukrainian prime minister had spoken of adversaries as subhuman, which he proposed as evidence of the Nazi convictions and behavior of the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainian prime minister had in fact written a statement of condolence to the Ukrainian families of soldiers killed in action, in which he used the word inhuman, nelyudi, to describe the attackers. Russian media then mistranslated the Ukrainian word into Russian as subhuman, nedotelovechi, and RT used the word subhuman in English language broadcasts. Cohen served as the final link in the chain, bringing the slander into American media. In one RT account, the mistranslation had been broadcast along with a series of other untruths and accompanied by graphic images of mass murder in Rwanda. The RT segment violated broadcasting standards in the United Kingdom and was pulled from the internet. Readers looking for the false subhuman claim could still turn to The Nation. When Russia shot down MH17 in July 2014, Cohen said, "We've had these shootdowns. We had them in the Cold War." The killing of civilians was dismissed by a vague reference to the past. A Russian weapon with a Russian crew during a Russian invasion of Ukraine shot down a civilian airliner and killed 298 people. A state transferred soldiers and weapons, an officer gave an order to fire, pilots were killed in a cockpit as shrapnel ripped through their bodies, a plane was ripped apart 10 kilometers above the earth, children, women, and men died in sudden terror, their body parts scattered over the countryside. On July 18, 2014, the day that Cohen said this, Russian television was broadcasting its multiple versions of the event. Rather than explaining to Americans what reporters knew, that multiple Ukrainian aircraft had been shot down by Russian weapons in the same place in prior weeks, and that the Russian GRU officer Igor Girkin had claimed credit for shooting down the aircraft that turned out to be MH17, Cohen changed the subject to the Cold War. This idea that Russia's anti-gay policies and its invasion of Ukraine were a new Cold War was a meme spread within Russia by the fascists of the Izborsk Club and then by right-wing politicians on RT, Marine Le Pen, beginning in 2011, and Richard Spencer, beginning in 2013. The term became a mainstay in the pages of The Nation in 2014, thanks to articles by Cohen and the journal's publisher, Katrina Vandenhoevel. On July 24, 2014, Vandenhoevel claimed on television that Moscow was calling for a ceasefire in a civil war. In speaking in this way, she was separating Russia from a conflict in which it was the aggressor. At that moment, the prime ministers of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Lugansk People's Republic were not Ukrainians, but Russian citizens brought in by Russian forces, political technologists with no connection to Ukraine. In their public relations capacity, they were promoting the very civil war concept that Vandenhoevel was helping to spread. At the time of her television appearance, the Russian citizen in charge of security was Vladimir Antufeyev, who characterized the conflict as a war against the international Masonic conspiracy and foretold the destruction of the United States. Vandenhoevel was speaking 1 week after MH17 had been shot down by a Russian weapon system, during a summer in which Russian transfers of weapons across the border were widely reported. She was speaking of a civil war during a massive Russian artillery barrage from Russian territory. A Russian journalist at the launch site had reported that Russia is shelling Ukraine from its own territory, and wrote of the military aggression of Russia against Ukraine. As Vandenhoevel was speaking, thousands of Russian soldiers from units based all over the Russian Federation were massing at the Russian-Ukrainian border. These elementary realities of the Russian war on Ukraine, known at the time thanks to the work of Russian and Ukrainian reporters, were submerged by the nation in propaganda tropes. Important writers of the British left repeated the same Russian talking points. In The Guardian, John Pilger wrote in May 2014 that Putin was the only leader to condemn the rise of fascism. This was an unwise conclusion to draw from current events. Just a few days earlier, neo-Nazis had marched on the streets of Moscow without meeting condemnation from their president. A few weeks earlier, on Russian state television, a Russian anchor had claimed that Jews brought the Holocaust on themselves, and her interlocutor, Alexander Prokhanov, had agreed. Putin's government paid the anchorwoman, and Putin himself made media appearances with Prokhanov, who also took a joyride in a Russian bomber, a rather clear expression of official support. These people were not condemned. Russia at the time was assembling the European far right, as electoral observers, as soldiers in the field, and as propagators of its messages. Moscow had organized meetings of European fascists and was subsidizing France's far-right party, the Front National. How were opinion leaders of the left seduced by Vladimir Putin, the global leader of the extreme right? Russia generated tropes targeted at what cyber war professionals call susceptibilities, what people seem likely to believe given their utterances and behavior. It was possible to claim that Ukraine was a Jewish construction for one audience, and also that Ukraine was a fascist construction for another audience. People on the left were drawn in by stimuli on social media that spoke to their own commitments. Pilger wrote his article under the influence of a text he found on the internet, purportedly written by a physician detailing supposed Ukrainian atrocities in Odessa. But the doctor did not exist and the event did not take place. The Guardian's correction noted only that Pilger's source, a fake social media page, had subsequently been removed. Far gentler that than to say that the most read article about Ukraine in that newspaper in 2014 was a translation of Russian political fiction into English. Guardian associate editor Seamus Milne opined in January 2014 that far-right nationalists and fascists have been at the heart of the protests in Ukraine. This corresponded not to The Guardian's reporting from Ukraine, but to the Russian propaganda line. Milne dismissed from the record the labors of about a million Ukrainian citizens to turn the rule of law against oligarchy, an odd turn for a newspaper with a left-wing tradition. Even after Putin had admitted that Russian forces were in Ukraine, Milne was claiming that the little green men were mostly Ukrainian. At Putin's presidential summit on foreign policy at Valdai in 2013, the Russian president had claimed that Russia and Ukraine were one people. Milne chaired a session of the 2014 summit at Putin's invitation. None of these people, Milne, Pilger, Cohen, Vandenhoevel, LaRouche, Paul, provided a single interpretation that was not available on RT. In some cases, as with Paul and LaRouche, the debt to Russian propaganda was acknowledged. Even those whose work was published adjacent to actual reporting, in The Nation or in The Guardian, ignored the investigations of actual Russian and Ukrainian reporters. None of these influential American and British writers visited Ukraine, which would have been the normal journalistic practice. Those who spoke so freely of conspiracies, coups, juntas, camps, fascists, and genocides shied from contact with the real world. From a distance, they used their talents to drown a country in unreality. In so doing, they submerged their own countries and themselves. Enormous amounts of time were wasted in Britain, the United States, and Europe in 2014 and 2015 on discussions about whether Ukraine existed and whether Russia had invaded it. That triumph of informational warfare was instructive for Russian leaders. In the invasion of Ukraine, the main Russian victories were in the minds of Europeans and Americans, not on the battlefields. Far-right politicians spread Russia's messages, and left-wing journalists helped to bring them to the center. One of the left-wing journalists then entered the corridors of power. In October 2015, Seamus Milne, having chaired Putin's Valdai summit, became chief of communications for Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of Britain's Labour Party. With Milne as his chief press officer, Corbyn proved a poor advocate for EU membership. British voters chose to leave, and Moscow celebrated. In July 2016, not long after the Brexit referendum, Donald Trump said, "Putin is not going into Ukraine. You can mark it down." The Russian invasion of Ukraine had begun more than 2 years before, in February 2014, right after snipers murdered Ukrainians on the Maidan. It was thanks to that very set of events that Trump had a campaign manager. Yanukovych fled to Russia, but his advisor Paul Manafort kept working for a pro-Russian party in Ukraine through the end of 2015. Manafort's new employer, the opposition bloc, was precisely the part of the Ukrainian political system that wanted to do business with Russia while Russia was invading Ukraine. This was the perfect transition to Manafort's next job. In 2016, he moved to New York and took over the management of Trump's campaign. In 2014, Trump had known that Russia had invaded Ukraine. Under Manafort's tutelage, Trump proclaimed Russian innocence. Lyndon LaRouche and Ron Paul were taking the same line at the time. Russia had done nothing wrong, and Europeans and Americans were to blame for the Russian invasion, which perhaps had happened and perhaps had not. Writing in The Nation in the summer and autumn of 2016, Cohen defended Trump and Manafort and dreamed that Trump and Putin would one day come together and remake the world order. The mendacity and the fascism of the Russian assault upon the European Union and the United States, of which the Trump campaign was a part, was a natural story for the left. However, few on the left took Trump and his own political fiction seriously in 2016. Perhaps this was because writers they trusted were not analysts of, but rather participants in, the Russian campaign to undermine factuality. In any event, Ukraine was the warning that went unheeded. When a presidential candidate from a fictional world appeared in the United States, Ukrainians and Russians noted the familiar patterns, but few on the American right or the American left listened. When Moscow brought to bear in the United States the same techniques used in Ukraine, few on the American right or the American left noticed. And so, the United States was defeated, Trump was elected, the Republican Party was blinded, and the Democratic Party was shocked. Russians supplied the political fiction, but Americans were asking for it. Chapter 6. Equality or Oligarchy, 2016. Nothing was more to be desired than that every practicable obstacle should be opposed to cabal, intrigue, and corruption. These most deadly adversaries of Republican government might naturally have been expected to make their approaches from more than one quarter, but chiefly from the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our councils. How could they better gratify this than by raising a creature of their own to the chief magistracy of the Union? Alexander Hamilton, 1788. Ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay. Oliver Goldsmith, 1770. Vladimir Putin's eternity regime challenged political virtues, undoing a succession principle in Russia, assaulting integration in Europe, invading Ukraine to stop the creation of new political forms. His grandest campaign was a cyber war to destroy the United States of America. For reasons having to do with American inequality, Russian oligarchy won an extraordinary victory in 2016. Because it did, inequality became a still greater American problem. The rise of Donald Trump was the attack by these most deadly adversaries of Republican government that Alexander Hamilton had feared. Russian leaders openly and exuberantly backed Trump's candidacy. Throughout 2016, Russian elites said with a smile that Trump is our president. Dmitry Kiselyov, the leading man of the Russian media, rejoiced that a new star is rising, Trump. The Eurasianists felt the same way. Alexander Dugin posted a video entitled In Trump We Trust and urged Americans to vote for Trump. Alexei Pushkov, the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee of the lower house of the Russian parliament, expressed the general hope that Trump can lead the Western locomotive right off the rails. Some Russians tried to alert Americans. Andrei Kozyrov, a former foreign minister, explained that Putin realizes that Trump will trample American democracy and damage, if not destroy, America as a pillar of stability and major force able to contain him. The Russian media machine was at work on Trump's behalf. As a Russian journalist later explained, we were given very clear instructions to show Donald Trump in a positive way and his opponent, Hillary Clinton, in the negative way. The Russian propaganda outlet Sputnik used the Crooked Hillary hashtag on Twitter, a gesture of respect and support for Trump, since the phrase was his, and also associated Clinton with nuclear war. Trump appeared on RT to complain that the U.S. media was untruthful, which for RT was the perfect performance. Its entire reason for being was to expose the single truth that everyone lied, and here was an American saying the same thing. When Trump won the presidential election that November, he was applauded in the Russian parliament. Trump quickly telephoned Putin to be congratulated. Kisilov, the leading man of the Russian media, celebrated Trump as the return of manhood to politics on his Sunday evening program, Vesti Nedeli. He fantasized before his viewers about Trump satisfying blondes, including Hillary Clinton. He was pleased that the words democracy and human rights are not in the vocabulary of Trump. Describing a meeting of Trump and Obama, Kisilov claimed that Obama was waving his arms as if he were in the jungle. In his commentary on Trump's inauguration, Kisilov said that Michelle Obama looked like the housekeeper. The politics of eternity are full of phantasmagoria, of bots and trolls, ghosts and zombies, dead souls and other unreal beings who escort a fictional character to power. Donald Trump, successful businessman, was not a person. It was a fantasy, born in the strange climate where the downdraft of the American politics of eternity, its unfettered capitalism, met the rising hydrocarbon fumes of the Russian politics of eternity, its kleptocratic authoritarianism. Russians raised a creature of their own to the presidency of the United States. Trump was the payload of a cyber weapon, meant to create chaos and weakness, as in fact he has done. Trump's advance to the Oval Office had three stages, each of which depended upon American vulnerability and required American cooperation. First, Russians had to transform a failed real estate developer into a recipient of their capital. Second, this failed real estate developer had to portray, on American television, a successful businessman. Finally, Russia intervened with purpose and success to support the fictional character Donald Trump, successful businessman, in the 2016 presidential election. Throughout the exercise, Russians knew what was fact and what was fiction. Russians knew Trump for what he was, not the very successful businessman of his tweets, but an American loser who became a Russian tool. Although Americans might dream otherwise, no one who mattered in Moscow believed that Trump was a powerful tycoon. Russian money had saved him from the fate that would normally await anyone with his record of failure. From an American point of view, Trump Tower is a garish building on Fifth Avenue in New York City. From a Russian point of view, Trump Tower is an inviting site for international crime. Russian gangsters began to launder money by buying and selling apartment units in Trump Tower in the 1990s. The most notorious Russian hitman, long sought by the FBI, resided in Trump Tower. Russians were arrested for running a gambling ring from the apartment beneath Trump's own. In Trump World Tower, constructed between 1999 and 2001 on the east side of Manhattan near the United Nations, a third of the luxury units were bought by people or entities from the former Soviet Union. A man investigated by the Treasury Department for money laundering lived in Trump World Tower directly beneath Kellyanne Conway, who had become the press spokeswoman for the Trump campaign. 700 units of Trump properties in South Florida were purchased by shell companies. Two men associated with those shell companies were convicted of running a gambling and laundering scheme from Trump Tower. Perhaps Trump was entirely unaware of what was happening on his properties. By the late 1990s, Trump was generally considered to be uncreditworthy and bankrupt. He owed about $4 billion to more than 70 banks, of which some $800 million was personally guaranteed. He never showed any inclination or capacity to pay back this debt. After his 2004 bankruptcy, no American bank would lend him money. The only bank that did so was Deutsche Bank, whose colorful history of scandal belied its staid name. Interestingly, Deutsche Bank also laundered about $10 billion for Russian clients between 2011 and 2015. Trump declined to pay back his debts to Deutsche Bank. A Russian oligarch bought a house from Trump for $55 million more than Trump had paid for it. The buyer, Dmitry Lebelovlev, never showed any interest in the property and never lived there, But later, when Trump ran for president, Ribolovlev appeared in places where Trump was campaigning. Trump's apparent business, real estate development, had become a Russian charade. Having realized that apartment complexes could be used to launder money, Russians used Trump's name to build more buildings. As Donald Trump Jr. said in 2008, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets. We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia." The Russian offers were hard to refuse. Millions of dollars up front for Trump, a share of the profits for Trump, Trump's name on a building, but no investment required from Trump. These terms suited both sides. In 2006, citizens of the former Soviet Union financed the construction of Trump Soho and gave Trump 18% of the profits, although he put up no money himself. In the case of Felix Sater, the apartments were currency laundromats. A Russian-American, Sater worked as senior advisor of the Trump Organization from an office in Trump Tower, two floors below Trump's own. Trump depended upon the Russian money Sater brought through an entity known as the Bayrock Group. Sater arranged for people from the post-Soviet world to buy apartments using shell companies. From 2007, Sater and Bayrock were helping Trump around the world, cooperating on at least four projects. Some of these failed, but Trump made money regardless. Russia is not a wealthy country, but its wealth is highly concentrated. It is thus common practice for Russians to place someone in their debt by providing easy money and naming the price later. As a candidate for the office of president, Trump broke with decades of tradition by not releasing his tax returns, presumably because they would reveal his profound dependence on Russian capital. Even after he announced his candidacy for the office of president in June 2015, Trump was pursuing risk-free deals with Russians. In October 2015, near the time of a Republican presidential debate, he signed a letter of intent to have Russians build a tower in Moscow and put his name on it. He took to Twitter to announce that Putin loves Donald Trump. The final deal never went through, perhaps because it would have made the Russian sources of Trump's apparent success just a bit too obvious at the moment when his presidential campaign was gaining momentum. The fictional character, Donald Trump, successful businessman, had more important things to do. In the words of Felix Sater, writing in November 2015, "Our boy can become president of the United States, and we can engineer it." In 2016, just when Trump needed money to run a campaign, his properties became extremely popular for shell companies. In the half year between his nomination as the Republican candidate and his victory in the general election, some 70% of the units sold in his buildings were purchased not by human beings, but by limited liability companies. Russia's boy existed in the American mind thanks to a popular American television program, The Apprentice, where Trump portrayed a mogul capable of hiring and firing at will. The role came naturally to him, perhaps because pretending to be such a person was already his day job. On the show, the world was a ruthless oligarchy, where an individual's future depended upon the capricious whims of a single man. The climax in each episode came when Trump brought the pain. You're fired. When Trump ran for president, he did so on the premise that the world really was so, that a fictional character with fictional wealth who ignores law, despises institutions, and lacks sympathy can govern people by causing pain. Trump outshone Republican rivals at debates thanks to years of practice at playing a fictional character on television. Trump was broadcasting unreality, and had been for some time. In 2010, RT was helping American conspiracy theorists spread the false idea that President Barack Obama had not been born in the United States. This fiction, designed to appeal to the weaknesses of racist Americans who wished to imagine away their elected president, invited them to live in an alternative reality. In 2011, Trump became the spokesman of this fantasy campaign. He only had a platform to do so because Americans associated him with the successful businessman he played on television, a role which in turn was only possible because Russians had bailed him out. Fiction rested on fiction rested on fiction. From a Russian perspective, Trump was a failure who was rescued and an asset to be used to wreak havoc in American reality. The relationship was play-acted in Moscow at the Miss Universe pageant of 2013, where Trump preened before Putin, hoping that the Russian president would be his best friend. Trump's Russian partners knew he needed